This is Audible.
Genevieve Undead by Kim Newman. Read by Antonia Beamish. When he lost his love, his grief was gall. In his heart he wanted to leave it all and lose himself in the forests tall. But he answered instead his country's call. Tom Blackburn and George Bruns, The Ballad of Davy Crockett. Part 1. Stage Blood. Chapter 1. He had had a name once, but hadn't heard it spoken in years. Sometimes it was hard to remember what it had been. Even he thought of himself as the trapdoor demon. When they dared speak of him, that was what the company of the Varga Bruegel called their ghost. He had been haunting this building for years enough to know its secret byways. After springing the catch of the hidden trapdoor, he eased himself into box 7. First dangling by strong tentacles, then dropping the last inches to the familiar carpet. Tonight was the premiere of The Strange History of Dr. Zaikil and Mr. Chaida, originally by the Kislevite dramatist V.I. Teodorov, now adapted by the Varga Bruegel's genius-in-residence, Detlef Sierck. The trapdoor demon knew Teodorov's hoary melodrama from earlier translations and wondered how Detlef would bring life back to it. He'd taken an interest in rehearsals, particularly in the progress of his protégé, Eva Savinian, but had deliberately refrained from seeing the piece all through until tonight. When the curtain came down on the fifth act, the ghost would decide whether to give the play his blessing or his curse. He was recognised as the permanent and non-paying licensee of Box 7, and he was invoked whenever a production went well or ill. The success of A Farce of the Fog was laid to his approval of the comedy, and the disastrous series of accidents that plagued the never-premiered revival of Manfred von Diehl's Strange Flower were also set at his door. Some had glimpsed him, and a good many more fancied they had. A theatre was not a proper theatre without a ghost, and there were always old stagehands and character actors eager to pass on stories to frighten the little Coreens and apprentices who passed through the Varga Bruegel Memorial Playhouse. Even Detlef Sierck, actor-manager of the Varga Bruegel Company, occasionally spoke with affection of him, and continued the custom of previous managements by having an offering placed in Box 7 on the first night of any production. Actually, for the ghost, things were much improved since Detlef took over the house. When the theatre had been the beloved of Shalya and specialised in under-patronised but uplifting religious dramas, the offerings had been of incense and a live kid. Now, reflecting an earthier, more popular approach, the offering took the form of a large trencher of meats and vegetables, prepared by the skilled company chef, with a couple of bottles of Bretonian wine thrown in. The trapdoor demon wondered if Detlef instinctively understood his needs were far more those of a physical being than a disembodied spirit. Eating was difficult without hands, but the years had forced him to become used to his ruff of muscular appendages, and he was able to work the morsels up from the trencher towards the sucking, beaked hole of his mouth with something approaching dexterity. He had uncorked the first bottle with a quick constriction and took frequent swigs at a vintage that must have been laid down around the year of his birth. He brushed away the thought. His former life seemed less real now than the fictions which paraded before him every evening, and settled his bulk into the nest of broken chairs and cushions adapted to his shape, awaiting the curtain. He sensed the excitement of the first night crowd, and, from the darkness of Box 7, saw the glitter of jewels and silks down below. A Detlef Sierck premiere was an occasion in Altdorf for the court to come out and parade. The trapdoor demon understood the emperor himself was not present. Since his experience at the fortress of Drachenfels, Karl Franz disliked the theatre in general and Detlef Sierck's theatre in particular. But that Prince Luitpold was occupying the imperial box. Many of the finest and foremost of the empire would be in the house, as intent on being seen as on seeing the play. The critics were in their corner, quills bristling and inkpots ready. Wealthy merchants packed the stalls, looking up at the assembled courtiers and aristocrats in the circle, who, in their turn, looked to the imperial connections in the private boxes. A dignified explosion of clapping greeted the orchestra as Felix Huberman, the conductor, led his musicians in the imperial national anthem. Hail to the house of the second Wilhelm. The ghost resisted the impulse to flap his appendages together in a schlumpfing approximation of applause. In the imperial box, the future emperor appeared and graciously accepted the admiration of his future subjects. Prince Luitpold was a handsome boy, on the point of becoming a handsome young man. His companion for the evening was handsome too, although the trapdoor demon knew she was not young. Genevieve Dieudonné, dressed far more simply than the brocaded and lace-swathed Luitpold, appeared to be a girl of some 16 summers, but it was well known that Detlef Sierck's mistress was actually in her 668th year. A heroine of the empire, yet something of an embarrassment, she didn't look entirely comfortable in the imperial presence and tried to keep in the shadows while the prince waved to the crowd. Across the auditorium, the ghost caught the sharp glint of red in her eyes and wondered if her night sight could pierce the darkness that sweated like squid's ink from his paws. If the vampire girl saw him, she didn't betray anything. She was probably too nervous of her position to pay any attention to him. Heroine or not, a vampire's position in human society is precarious. Too many remembered the centuries Kislev suffered under Tsarina Catherine. Also in the prince's party was Mornan Tybalt, grey-faced and self-made keeper of the imperial counting house, and Graf Rüdiger von Unheimlich, hard-hearted and forceful patron of the League of Karl Franz, a to-the-death defender of aristocratic privilege. They were known to hate each other with a poisonous fervour, the upstart Tybalt having the temerity to believe that ability and intellect were more important qualifications for high office than breeding, lineage and a title, while the pure-blooded Huntsman von Unheimlich maintained that all Tybalt's policies had brought to the empire was riot and upheaval. The trapdoor demon fancied that neither the Chancellor nor the Graf would have much attention for the play, each fuming at the imperially ordained need not to attempt physical violence upon the other in the course of the evening. The house settled and the prince took his chair. It was time for the drama. The ghost adjusted his position and fixed his attention on the opening curtains. Beyond the red velvet was darkness. Huberman held a flute to his lips and played a strange high melody. Then the limelights flared and the audience was transported to another century, another country. The action of Dr. Zeichill and Mr. Chaida was set in pre-Catherine Kislev and concerned a humble cleric of Shalya who, under the influence of a magic potion, transforms into another person entirely, a prodigy of evil. In the first scene, Zeichill was debating good and evil with his philosopher brother, as the darkness gathered outside the temple, seeping in between the stately columns. It was easy to see what attracted Detlef Sierck as adapter and actor to the Teodorov story. The dual role was a challenge beyond anything the performer had done before, and the subject was an obvious development of the macabre vein that had been creeping lately into the playwright's work. Even the comedy of A Farce of the Fog had found room for a throat-slitting imp and much talk of the hypocrisy of supposedly good men. Critics traced Detlef's dark obsessions back to the famously interrupted premiere of his work Drachenfels, during which the actor had faced and bested not a stage monster, but the great enchanter himself, Constant Drachenfels. Detlef had tackled that experience face-on in The Treachery of Oswald, in which he had taken the role of the possessed Laszlo Lohenstein, and now he was returning to the hurt inside him, nagging again at the themes of duality, treachery, and the existence of a monstrous world underneath the ordinary. His brother gone, Zeichel was locked up in his chapel, fussing with the bubbling liquids that combined to make his potion. Detlef, intent on delaying the expected, was playing the scene with a comic touch, as if Zeichel weren't quite aware what he was doing. In his recent works, Detlef's view of evil was changing, as if he were coming to believe it was not an external thing, like Drachenfels usurping the body of Lohenstein, but a canker that came from within, like the treachery forming in the heart of Oswald, or the murderous, lecherous, spiteful Chaida straining to escape from the confines of the pious, devout, kindly Zeichel. On the stage, the potion was ready. Detlef, as Zeichel, drained it, and Huberman's eerie tune began again as the influence of the magic took hold. Dr. Zeichel and Mr. Chaida forced the trapdoor demon to consider things he would rather forget. As Chaida first appeared, with Detlef performing marvels of stage magic and facial contortion to suggest the violent transformation, he remembered his own former shape and the Zeench-born changes that slowly overcame him. When, at the point Detlef as Chaida was strangling Zeichel's brother, the monster was pulled back inside the cleric and Zeichel, chastened and shaking, stood revealed before the philosopher, the ghost was slapped by the realization that this would never happen to him. Zeichel and Chaida might be in an eternal struggle, neither ever gaining complete control, but he was forever, and for good or ill, the trapdoor demon. He would never revert to his old self. Then the drama caught him again, and he was tugged from his own thoughts, gripped by the way Detlef retold the tale. In Teodorov, the two sides of the protagonist were reflected by the two women associated with them, Zeichel with his virtuous wife, and Chaida with a brazen slut of the streets. Detlef had taken this tired cliché and replaced the stick figures with human beings. Sonia Zeichel, played by Ilona Horvathy, was a restless, passionate woman, bored enough with her husband to take a young Cossack as a lover, and attracted, despite herself, to the twisted and dangerous Mr. Chaida. While Nita, the harlot, was played by Eva Savinian as a lost child, willing to endure the brutal treatment of Chaida because the monster at least pays her some attention. The murder scene drew gasps from the auditorium, and the ghost knew Detlef would, in order to increase the clamour for tickets, spread around a rumour that ladies fainted by the dozen. While Detlef's Chaida might be a triumph of the stage, the most chilling depiction of pure evil he had ever seen, there was no doubt that the revelation of the play was Eva Savinian's tragic Nita. In A Farce of the Fog, Eva had taken and transformed the dullest of parts, the faithful maidservant, and this was her first chance to graduate to anything like a leading role. Eva's glowing performance made the ghost's chest swell, wet with pride, for she was currently his special interest. Noticing her when she first came to the company, he had exerted his influence to help her along. Eva's triumph was also his. Her, Nita, quite outshone Ilona Horvathy's higher-billed heroine, and the trapdoor demon wondered whether there was anything of Genevieve Dieudonné in Detlef's writing of the part. The scene was the low dive behind the Temple of Shalya, where Chaida makes his lodging, and Chaida was trying to get rid of Nita. Earlier, he had arranged an assignation here with Sonia, believing his seduction of the wife he still believed virtuous will signify an utter triumph over the Zeichill half of his soul. The argument that led to murder was over the pettiest of things, a pair of shoes without which Nita refuses to go out into the snow-thick streets of Kislev. Gradually, a little fire came into Nita's complaints, and for the first time she tried to stand up to her brutish protector. Finally, almost as an afterthought, Chaida struck the girl down with a mailed glove, landing a blow of such force that a splash of blood erupted from her skull, like juice from a crushed orange. Stage blood flew. Then came the climax. As the young Kislevite Cossack, played by the athletic and dynamic Reinhard Jessner, having tracked Chaida down from his earlier crimes, bursts into the fiend's lodgings, accompanied by Zeichill's wife and brother, and puts an end to the monster during a sword fight. The trapdoor demon had seen Detlef and Reinhard duel before, at the climax of The Treachery of Oswald, but this was a far more impressive display. The combat went so far beyond performance, he was sure real enmity must exist between them. Offstage, Reinhardt was married to Ilona Horvathy, to whom Detlef had made love in the company's last three productions. Also, Reinhardt was being hailed as the new matinee idol of the Playhouse. His attractions for the young women of Altdorf were growing, even as those of his genius employer diminished somewhat. Although diminishing was certainly not what Detlef's stomach was doing, with passing years of good food and better wine. Detlef and Reinhardt fought in the persons of Chaida and the Cossack, hacking away at each other until their faces were crisscrossed with bloody lines and the stage set was a shambles. Slashing a curtain exposed the hastily stuffed away corpse of Nita, and Sonia Zeichill fainted in her brother-in-law's arms. Not a breath was let out in the auditorium. In Teodorov's original, Chaida was defeated when Zeichill at last managed to exert himself and the monster dropped his sword. Skewered by the Cossack's blade, Chaida turned back into Zeichill in death, declaiming in a dying speech that he had learned his lesson, that mortals should not tamper with the affairs of the gods. Detlef had changed it around completely. At the point when the transformation began, the Cossack made his death thrust, and Chaida parried it, striking with his killing glove and crushing the young hero's throat. There was a shocked reaction in the house to this reversal of expectations. It had been Zeichill who had killed his wife's lover, not Chaida. This wasn't the story of the division between good and evil in a man's soul, but of an evil that drives out even the good. Throughout the third act, the ghost realised Detlef had been blurring the differentiation between Zeichill and Chaida. Now, at the end, they were indistinguishable. He didn't need the potion anymore. In a cruel final touch, Zeichill gave his bloody sword to his wife, of whose corruption he approves, and encouraged her to taste further the delights of evil by killing Zeichill's brother. Sonia, needing no potion to unloose the monster inside her, complied. With corpses all around, Zeichill then took his wife to Chaida's bed, and the curtain fell. For a long moment, there was a stunned silence from the audience. The ghost wondered how they would react. Looking across the dark, he saw again the red points of Genevieve's eyes and wondered what emotion was hidden in them. Dr. Zeichill and Mr. Chaida was hard to like, but it was undoubtedly Detlef Sieck's dark masterpiece. No one who saw it would ever forget it, no matter how much they might wish to. The applause began and grew to a deafening storm. The trapdoor demon joined his clamour with the rest. Chapter 2. The future emperor had been impressed with the play. Genevieve knew that would please Detlef. Elsewhere at the party, there was heated debate about the merits of the strange history of Dr. Zeichill and Mr. Chaida. Mornan Tybalt, the thin-nosed Chancellor, quietly expressed extreme disapproval, while Graf Rüdiger had apparently yawned throughout and glumly didn't see what all the fuss was about. Two critics were on the point of blows, one proclaiming the piece an immortal masterpiece, the other reaching into the stable for his metaphors. Guglielmo Pentangeli, Detlef's business manager and former cellmate, was happy, predicting that whatever a person might think of Dr. Zeichill and Mr. Chaida, it would be impossible to venture out in society in the next year without having formed an opinion. And to form an opinion, it would be necessary to procure a ticket. Genevieve felt watched, as she had all evening, but no one talked to her about the play. That was to be expected. She was in a peculiar position, connected with Detlef and yet not with his work. Some might think it impolite to express an opinion to her or to solicit her own. She felt strange anyway, distanced from the play she'd seen, not quite able to connect it with the man whose bed she shared, if rarely using it at the same time he did, or else able to understand too well the sparks in Detlef that made him at once Dr. Zeichill and Mr. Chaida. Recently, Detlef had been darkening inside. In the reception room of the Vagabruegel, invited guests were drinking and picking at the buffet. Felix was conducting a quartet in a suite of pieces from the play, and Guglielmo was doing his best to be courteous to von Unheimlich, who was describing at length an error in Reinhardt's Kislevite swordsmanship. A courtier Genevieve had met, whom she had once bled in a private suite at the Crescent Moon Tavern, complimented her on her dress, and she smiled back at him, able to remember his name but not his precise title. Even after nearly 700 years in and out of the courts of the known world, she was confused by etiquette. The players were still backstage, taking off makeup and costumes. Detlef would also be running through his notes to the other actors. For him, every performance was a dress rehearsal for an ideal, perfect rendition of the drama that might, by some miracle, eventually transpire, but which never actually came to pass. He said that as soon as he stopped being disappointed in his work, he'd give up. Not because he would have attained perfection, but because he would have lost his mind. The eating and drinking reminded Genevieve of her own need. Tonight, when the party was over, she'd tap Detlef. That would be the best way jointly to savour his triumph, to lick away the tiny scabs under his beardline and to sample his blood, still peppered with the excitement of the performance. She hoped he didn't drink to excess. Too much wine in the blood gave her a headache. "Genevieve," said Prince Luitpold, "your teeth." She felt them, sharp against her lower lip, and bowed her head. The enamel shrank, and her fangs slid back into their gum sheaths. "Sorry," she said. "Don't be," the prince said, almost laughing. "It's not your fault. It's your nature." Genevieve realised Mornan Tybalt, who had no love for her, was watching closely, as if he expected her to tear out the throat of the heir to the imperial crown and put her face into a gusher of royal blood. She had tasted royal blood, and it was no different from a goat herd's. Since the fall of the arch-lector Michael Hasselstein, Mornan Tybalt had been the emperor's closest adviser, and he was jealous of the position, afraid of anyone, no matter how insignificant or unlikely, who might win favour with the house of the second Wilhelm. Genevieve understood the ambitious chancellor was not a well-liked man, especially with those whose hero was the Graf Rüdiger, the old guard of the aristocracy, the electors and the barons. Genevieve took people as she found them, but had been involved enough with the great and the good not to want to pick sides in any factional conflicts of the imperial court. "Here's our genius," the prince said. Detlef made an entrance, transformed from the ragged monster of the play into an affable dandy, dressed as magnificently as the company costumier could manage, his embroidered doublet confining his stomach in a flattering manner. He bowed low to the prince and kissed the boy's ring. Luitpold had the decency to be embarrassed, and Tybalt looked as if he expected another assassination attempt. Of course, the reason Detlef and Genevieve were allowed such intimacy with the imperial presence was that at Castle Drachenfels they had thwarted such an attempt. If it were not for the play-actor and the bloodsucker, the empire would now be ruled by a puppet of the great enchanter, and there would be a new dark age for all the races of the world. A darker age, rather. The prince complimented Detlef on the play, and the actor-playwright brushed aside the praise with extravagant modesty, simultaneously appearing humble, yet conveying how pleased he was to have his patron bestow approval. The other actors were arriving. Reinhardt, a bandage around his head where Detlef had struck too hard in the final fight, was flanked by his wife, Ilona, and the ingenue. Several artistically inclined gallants crowded around Eva, and Genevieve detected a slight moue of jealousy from Ilona. Prince Luitpold himself had asked if an introduction could be contrived to the young actress. Eva Savinian would have to be watched.
"Ulrich, but that was a show,"
Reinhardt said, as open as usual, rubbing his wound.
"The trapdoor demon should be delighted."
Genevieve laughed at his joke. The trapdoor demon was a popular superstition in the Vargabroigel. Detlef was given wine and held his own court.
"Genet, my love," he said, kissing her cheek. "You look wonderful."
She shivered a little in his embrace, unconvinced by his warmth. He was always playing a part. It was his nature.
"It was a feast of horrors, Detlef," the prince said. "I was never so frightened in my life. Well, maybe once."
Detlef, briefly serious, acknowledged the comment. Genevieve suppressed another shiver and realised it had passed around the room. She could see momentarily haunted faces in the cheerful company. Detlef, Luitpold, Reinhardt, Ilona, Felix. Those who'd been at the performance in Castle Drachenfels would always be apart from the rest of the world. Everyone had been changed, and Detlef most of all. They all felt unseen eyes gazing down on them.
"We've had too many horrors in Altdorf,"
Tybalt commented, a mutilated hand stroking his chin.
"The business 5 years ago with Drachenfels, Conrad the Hero's little skirmish with our green-skinned friends, the beast murders, the riots stirred up by the revolutionist Klejowski, now this business with the warhawk."
Several citizens had been slaughtered recently by a falconer who set a hunting bird on them. Captain Harold Kleindienst, reputedly the hardest copper in the city, had vowed to bring the murderer to justice, but the killer was still at liberty, striking down those who took his fancy.
"It seems," the Chancellor continued, "we are knee-deep in blood and cruelty. Why do you feel the need to add to our burden of nightmares?"
Detlef was silent for a moment. Tybalt had asked a question many must have pondered during the evening. Genevieve didn't care for the man, but she admitted that just once he might have a point.
"Well, Sirk,"
Tybalt insisted, pressing his argument beyond politeness.
"Why dwell on terrors?"
The look came into Detlef's eyes that Genevieve had learned to recognise. The dark look that came whenever he remembered the fortress of Drachenfels. The Chaida look that eclipsed his Zykhil face.
"Chancellor," he said, "what makes you think I have a choice?"
Chapter 3. Upon this peak in the grey mountains, there had once been a castle. It had stood against the sky, 7 turrets like the talons of a deformed hand. This had been the fortress of Constant Drachenfels, the great enchanter. Now there was only a scattering of rubble that drifted like snow into the valley, spreading out for miles. Explosives had been placed throughout the structure and detonated. The fortress of Drachenfels had shaken and collapsed piece by piece. Where once there had been a stronghold, there was now a ruin. The intention had been to destroy completely all trace of the master of the castle. Stone and slate could be smashed, but it was impossible to blow away like chaff the horrors that lay in memories. Buried in the ruins for these 5 years was the Animus, a thinking creature with no true form. Just now, it resided in a mask, a plain oval, like a large half-eggshell, wrought from light metal, so thin as to be almost transparent. It had features, but they were unformed, undefined. To gain character, the mask needed to be worn. The Animus was not sure what it was. Constant Drachenfels had either created it or conjured it. A homunculus or a spirit, it owed its existence to the great enchanter. Drachenfels had worn the mask once and left something of himself behind. That gave purpose to the Animus. It had been left in the ruins when Drachenfels departed the world for one reason. Revenge. Genevieve Dudonnet, Detlef Sierck, the vampire and the play actor, the thwarters of the great design. They had destroyed Drachenfels, and now they must themselves be destroyed. The Animus was patient. Time passed, but it could wait. It would not die. It would not change. It could not be reasoned with. It could not be bought off. It could not be swayed from its purpose. It sensed the disturbance in the ruins and knew it was being brought closer to Genevieve and Detlef. The Animus did not feel excitement, just as it did not feel hate, love, pain, pleasure, satisfaction, discomfort. The world was as it was, and there was nothing it could do to change that. As the moon set, the disturbance neared the Animus. As they made love, Genevieve licked the trickle of blood from old wounds in his throat. Over the years, her teeth had put permanent marks on him, a seal. Detlef had taken to wearing high collars, and all his shirts had tiny red stains where they rested against her bites. His head sunk deep into the pillow, and he looked at the ceiling, vision going in and out of focus as she suckled his blood. His hand was on her neck, under her blonde curtain of hair. They were joined, loin to loin, neck to mouth. They were one flesh, one blood. He had tried to paint the experience with words in one of his still-secret sonnets, but had never managed to his satisfaction to catch the butterfly feelings, pain and pleasure. In many ways, his chosen tool, language, failed him. Genevieve made him forget the actresses he sometimes took to his bed, and wondered if she too found this joining more special than her brief liaisons with young bloods. Their partnership wasn't conventional, hardly even convenient. But even as he felt the darkness gathering, this ancient girl was the candle flame to which he must cling. Since Drachenfels, they had been together, sharing secrets. A thrill shot through him, and he heard her gasp, blood bubbling in the back of her throat, knife-point teeth scratching the leathered skin of his neck. They rolled over, together, and she clung to him as their bodies joined and parted. There was blood between them and sweet sweat. He looked at her smiling face under his in the gloom, and saw her lick the red from her lips. He felt himself climaxing, first in the soles of his feet. Then his heart hammered. Genevieve's eyes opened, and she shuddered, overlapping teeth, bared and bloody. He propped himself above her, elbows rigid, and collapsed, trying to keep his weight off her. Their bodies slipped apart, and Genevieve eased herself forwards, almost clambering over his bulk, pressing her face to his cheek, her hair falling over his face, kissing him. He pulled the quilts up around them, and they nestled in a cocoon of warmth as the sun rose behind the curtains. For once, their sleep came at the same time. With the play and the party and their private embraces, they'd both been awake the night through. Detlef was exhausted, Genevieve in the grip of the vampire lassitude that came over her every few weeks. His eyes closed, and he was alone in the dark of his mind. He slept, but his thoughts still raced. He needed to work on the sword fight to prevent more accidents, and he would have to give thought to Ilona to balance the blossoming Eva's performance. And the second act could use delicate pruning. The comic business with the Tsar's minister was just a tiresome leftover from Teodorov. He dreamed of changing faces. This high in the grey mountains, the air was as sharp as a razor. As he inhaled, he felt its cutting pass in his lungs. Trying desperately not to wheeze and thus lose his habitual decorum, Bernabe Scheit completed his mid-morning devotions to the gods of law, Sulcan, Arianka, and Illuminas. At the dig, the first thing he had ordered was the erection of a sundial, a fixed point on the world, shadow revolving precisely with the inexorable movement of sun and moons. The sundial was the perfect altar for worship of order. "Master Scheit," said Brother Jacinto, touching his own forehead in a mark of respect, "there was a subsidence in the night. The ground has fallen in where we were digging yesterday." "Show me." The acolyte led him to the place. Scheit was used to hopping around the ruin, judging which lumps of rubble were sound enough to be stepped on. It was important not to fall over. Every time someone so much as tripped, two or three of the workforce deserted in the night. The locals remembered Drachenfels too well and feared his return. Every slightest mishap was laid to the lingering spirit of the great enchanter. Many more, and the expedition would be reduced to Scheit and the acolytes the archlector had spared him, and acolytes dug a lot less well than the mountain men. The superstitious fever of the locals was nonsense. At the beginning of the expedition, Scheit had invoked the dread name of Sulcan and performed a rite of exorcism. If any trace of the monster lingered, it was banished now to the outer darkness. Order reigned where there had once been chaos. Still, there had been incidents. "Here," said Jacinto. Scheit saw. A half-rotten wooden beam was balanced over a square pit. A few slabs angled into the edges, like the teeth of a giant. An earthy, shitty, dead thing smell fumed up from the hole. It must have been one of the cellars.
"Yes," Scheit agreed. The earliest rising workmen stood around. Jacinto was the only one of the acolytes up from their comparatively comfortable village lodgings this morning. Brother Nakbar and the others were poring over and cataloguing the expedition's earlier finds. Back at the university in Altdorf, the archlector must be pleased with the success of this dig. The acquisition of knowledge, even knowledge of the evil and unholy, was one way in which the cult of Sulcan imposed order upon chaos.
"We must pray," Scheit declared, "to ensure our safety."
He heard a suppressed groan. These peasants would rather be digging than praying, and they would rather be drinking than digging. They did not understand the law, did not understand how important order and decorum were to the world. They were only here because they feared Sulcan, master of vengeance, as much or more than they feared the ghosts of the castle. Jacinto was down on his knees, and the others, grumbling, followed him. Scheit read out the blessing of Sulcan.
"Free me from the desires of my body. Guide me in the path of the law. Instruct me in the ways of seemliness. Help me smite the enemies of order."
Since he had embraced the cult, Scheit had been rigid in his habits. Celibate, vegetarian, abstinent, ordered. Even his bowel movements were decided by the sundial. He wore the coarse robe of a cleric. He raised his hand to no one but the unrighteous. He prayed
at perfectly defined intervals. He was in balance with himself and with the world as it should be. The prayer concluded. Shait examined the hole in the ground. The Archlector had sent him to Drachenfels with orders to search out items of spiritual interest. The great enchanter had been a very evil man, but he'd had an unparalleled library, a vast collection of articles of power, a store of the most arcane secrets. Only by understanding chaos could the cult of Sulcan impose order. It was important to carry the battle to the enemy, to meet sorcery with cleansing fire, to root out and destroy the devotees of unclean gods. Only the strongest in mind could qualify for this expedition, and Shait was honoured by his selection as its director. "There's something down there," Jacinto said, "catching the light." The sun had risen and was shining now into the cavity. An object reflected. It was the shape of a face. "Get it," Shait said. The acolyte followed the order. Jacinto knew his place on the sundial. Two of the workmen lowered the young man into the cavity on a rope and then hauled him back out. He handed the article he had taken from the floor of the pit to Shait. It was a delicate metal mask. "Is it anything?" Jacinto asked. Shait was not sure. The object felt strange, warm to the touch, as if it retained the heat of the sun. It was not heavy, and there was no place for a cord to bind it to a head. His hands tingled as he held the mask up in front of him. He looked through the eye holes. Beyond the mask, the acolyte's face was distorted. Jacinto seemed impossibly to be sneering at his master, tongue poked out, hands flapping by his ears, eyes crossed. A flare of wrath went off in Shait's heart as he rested the mask against his skin. At once, something leapt into his skull, fastening on his brain. The mask was stuck to his face like a layer of paint, his cheeks convulsed, and he felt the metal move with his twitch. He saw Jacinto truly now, stumbling back away from him. He was still Bernabé Shait, cleric of Sulcan, but he was something else too. He was the Animus. His hands found the acolyte and lifted him up. With new strength, he held the struggling young man up high and tossed him into the pit. Jacinto crashed through the remaining beam and thumped, broken, against an unseen flagstone floor. The workmen were running away. Some screamed, some prayed. He enjoyed their fear. Shait, devotee of the law, tried to claw the mask from his face, horrified at the disorder he'd wrought. But the Animus grew strong in a moment and stayed his hands. The Animus burrowed into Shait, seeking out seeds of excess within his imprisoned heart, encouraging them to sprout. Shait wanted a woman, a roast pig, a barrel of wine. The Animus had found desires within its host and was prepared to help him slake them. Then it would travel. To Altdorf, to the vampire and the play actor. As the workmen tumbled and ran down the mountainside, Shait drew a huge breath and laughed like a demon. The straight trees that poked through the rubble bent in the breeze of laughter. Chapter 4. Detlef got to the theatre in the mid-afternoon, leaving Genevieve sleeping in their rooms on the other side of Temple Street. The rest of the company were there already, poring over the reviews. The Altdorf Spieler, which boasted a circulation in the hundreds, was stridently in favour of The Strange History of Dr. Zeitkill and Mr. Chaida, and most of the lesser broadsheets followed its line. Felix Huberman picked out phrases to be flagged across the posters, humming superlatives to himself as he underlined them. Gripping, powerful, thought-provoking, spine-chilling, bowel-churning, will run and run. Guglielmo reported that the house was sold out for the next 2 months and heavily booked thereafter. The Varga Bruegel had another hit. On the set, Popper Fritz, the stage doorkeeper and an institution in the theatre, was on his knees, trying to scrub blood out of the carpet. Detlef had ordered buckets cooked up in anticipation of a long run. When he had burst the bladder in his glove as he seemed to strike Eva Savinian, the whole audience had been shocked. He recalled the spurt of feeling that came at that moment, as if his own Mr. Chaida were gaining the ascendant, encouraging him to delight in horrors beyond imagining. As he entered the rehearsal room, cast and company broke into congratulatory applause. He bowed, accepting the praise that meant the most to him. Then he broke the cheer up by producing a scroll with a few more notes. When he was finished, and the girl who played the innkeeper's daughter had stopped crying, he was ready to consider the business matters Guglielmo Pentangeli thrust at him. He signed a few papers and contracts, including a letter of thanks to the Emperor for continuing his patronage of the Varga Bruegel.
"Does that hurt?" Guglielmo asked.
"What?"
"Your neck. You were scratching."
It had become an unconscious habit. His bites weren't painful, but sometimes they itched. Occasionally, after Genevieve bled him, he felt tired and drained. But today he was refreshed, eager for tonight's performance.
"Did you know the Chancellor had condemned the play in the strongest of terms? He said as much last night. It's here in the Spiele. Look."
Detlef cast his eyes down the column of blocky print. Mornan Tybalt had branded Dr. Zeichill and Mr. Chaida an obscenity and called for a ban on it. Apparently, the horrors of the play were an invitation to the feeble-minded to act in imitation. Tybalt cited the thumbtacks rioters, the beast and the warhawk as the logical results of a theatre exclusively concerned with the dark and the depraved, the violent and the vile. Detlef snorted a laugh.
"I thought those riots were a logical result of the silly tax Tybalt himself devised. He's still a powerful man at court." "A ban isn't likely, not with Prince Luitpold on our side. Be cautious, Detlef," advised Guglielmo. "Don't trust patrons, remember?"
He did. Detlef and Guglielmo had met in debtor's prison, after the default of a previous patron. After Munzen Keep, everything seemed like an unconvincing play. Sometimes he was certain the curtain would ring down and he would wake up back in his cell with the other stinking debtors and no hope of release. Even a terrible death at the hand of Drachenfels would have been preferable to a life slowly dribbled away in the dark.
"Have Tybalt's comments engraved on a board, and hang them outside the theatre with all our good notices. There's nothing that increases queues like a demand something should be banned. Remember the houses they got after the Lector of Sigmar tried to suppress Bruno Malvoisin's Seduced by Slaaneshi, or the baneful lusts of Diogo Brysac."
Guglielmo laughed.
"The trapdoor demon is with us, you know,"
Detlef said.
"I'm sure of it. Box 7 has been cleaned out."
"And?"
Guglielmo shrugged. "The food was gone, of course. It always goes."
This was a recurring joke between them. Guglielmo claimed the offerings were taken away by the house cleaners for their families, and that he should be allowed to put on sale tickets for Box 7. It was only a question of 5 seats, but they were the most potentially expensive in the house. Guglielmo, like all ex-debtors, knew the value of a crown and frequently mentioned how much the Varga Bruegel lost by not letting out Box 7.
"Any other signs of spectral visitation?" "That a peculiar smell, Detlef, and some slimy stuff."
"Ha!" Detlef exclaimed, delighted.
"You see? Many places smell funny, and slime is easy to come by in this place. A good fumigation and some new furniture and the box would be good as new. We need our ghostly patron, Guglielmo. Maybe."
The trapdoor demon heard Detlef and Guglielmo discuss him and was amused. He knew the actor-manager only pretended belief as a pose. Still, there was an obvious kinship between them. Once, years ago,
The ghost had been a playwright too. He was touched that Detlef remembered his work. Few others did. From his space behind the walls, he observed everything, eyes to the peepholes concealed in the scrollwork of a tall cabinet no one ever opened. There were peepholes all over the house, and passageways behind every wall. The theatre had been built at a time when the reigning emperor alternately persecuted and patronised the players, necessitating the incorporation of multiple means of escape into the building. Actors who failed to please were able to get away without encountering the emperor's halberdiers, who then had a reputation as the harshest dramatic critics in the city. Several players had got lost in the tunnels, and the ghost had found their skeletons, still in costume, strewn in nooks around the theatre's catacombs. There was no formal rehearsal this afternoon. Everyone was elated from the night before, and eager to repeat the performance this evening. The test of a hit was its second night, the trapdoor demon knew. Magic can sometimes strike once and be lost forever. From now on, the company of The Strange History of Dr. Zeichill and Mr. Chaida would have to work to live up to their reputation. Papa Fritz, who had been with the house almost as long as the ghost, handed out mugs of coffee and flirted with the chorus girls. If anyone was responsible for the endurance of the legend of the trapdoor demon, it was Papa Fritz. The stage doorkeeper had encountered him on more than one occasion, usually when in his cups, and always embroidered and elaborated when he told of these incidents. According to Papa Fritz, the ghost was 20 feet tall and glowed in the dark, with bright red skulls in the pupils of his huge eyes, and a cloak woven from the hair of slaughtered actresses. Detlef did what the trapdoor demon would have done, and concentrated on Ilona Horvathy and Eva Savinian. They had few scenes together, but the contrast between them was vital to the piece, and last night Eva had outshone Ilona to the detriment of the play. The trick was to bring the one up without taking the other down. Ilona was not in a good mood, but tried hard, listening intently to Detlef and following his instructions to the letter. She was intently aware of her position. Having had twins a few years ago, Ilona was constantly struggling to keep her figure. Last night, she must have realised that in the next Varga Bruegel production, Eva Savinian would be the leading lady, and she'd be playing somebody's mother. Reinhard Jessner, on hand merely to read his lines, gave his wife support, but was careful not to tread in the director's way. Eva, however, was quietly firm, displaying a backbone of steel in her willowy body. She might step from ingenue to star on the strength of Nita, and was even more careful than Ilona. She was not a flirt exactly, but she knew how to flatter without seeming to ingratiate without being unctuous, to further herself without displaying a hint of ambition. In the end, Eva would be a great star, an extraordinary presence. The trapdoor demon had seen that from the first, when she had had the merest walk-on as a dancer in The Treachery of Oswald. Since then, she'd grown inside. He felt pride in her achievements, but also nagging doubts. Just now, while Ilona and Detlef were playing the scene in which Sonia first meets and is attracted to Chaida, Eva sat on a table, hugging her knees, watching intently. And Reinhard Jessner was in a huddle with her, massaging an ache in her back. Before scaling the mountain, you first conquer the foothills. And the gossip was that Eva would doubtless seduce Reinhard away from Ilona before she tackled Detlef. The trapdoor demon discounted this rumour, for he knew the girl better, understood her more finely. She wouldn't have a personal life until her position was assured. Then Detlef was working with Eva, restaging their final argument, smiling encouragement when he wasn't spitting hateful lines at her. After their dialogue was over, Detlef lightly tapped Eva on the skull, and she fell down as if mightily smitten. The company applauded, and Reinhardt helped her up. The ghost
saw Ilona watching her husband intently, chewing a corner of her lip. Eva, without cruelty or encouragement, pushed Reinhardt away and paid attention to what Detlev told her about her performance, nodding agreement at his points, taking them in. The trapdoor demon realized he'd not misjudged Eva Savinian. The girl didn't need to bestow any favors. She would advance on talent alone. And yet, despite the affection he felt for her, he could not but realize there was something chilling about the girl. Like some great performers, there might not be any real person inside the roles.
All right, Detlev concluded. I'm happy. Let's go out there tonight and kill 'em.
Chapter 5. The mountain hall was snoring, eyes swollen shut, as Shait chewed his tough meat, washing the chunks down with bitter wine. He'd returned to his room and made his wishes known to the innkeeper in language blunter than the dolt was used to hearing from a cleric of the law. The animus rested inside his head as Shait fulfilled the desires that had been revealed to him. The mask was a part of him now, and he could open its mouth to eat, to speak, to gobble. Scratching himself, he stood over the shrine he had erected in the corner of the room when he first came to the inn. It was perfectly laid out, balanced and symmetrical, the symbol of the strength of order over chaos. An arrangement of metal rods and wooden panels around a central sundial, engraved with the sayings of the law, decorated with preserved leaves. He hiked up his robe and relieved himself on the shrine, washing away the leaves with his powerful flow of urine. The noise woke up the whore, and she rolled away, her head to the wall, sobbing. After years of self-denial, Shait hadn't been a gentle lover. There was a knocking at the door. "What is it?" Shait grunted. The door opened, and an acolyte ventured in. They must all be chattering about him. "Brother Nakbar?" The acolyte goggled at Shait, appalled at what he saw. He made the sign of the law, and Shait turned around, the last of his flow making a quarter circle on the floorboards. Shait let his robes fall. Nakbar could not speak. The animus told Shait he did not have to put up with fools like this for much longer. "Get me a horse," he ordered. "I'm leaving this pest hole." Nakbar nodded and retreated. The fool was so brain-blasted by the law that he would carry out Shait's orders, even if the cleric told him to consume his own excrement or slide.